Hi, and welcome back to the 2%. Today, I'm excited to share a conversation with Nancy Twine, the founder and CEO of Briogeo, the clean, high-performance hair care line that pioneered the skinification of hair care. At the age of 29, Nancy became the then-youngest Black woman to launch a product line at Sephora, and the brand has gone on to win dozens of awards for innovation, including Allure's Best of Beauty Awards in the prestige hair care space. In 2022, less than 10 years after launch, Nancy sold Briogeo to Wella Company. While Nancy continues in her role as founder and CEO, she's now evolving once again, harnessing the power of her business expertise and life experience to enrich the lives of her community. I'm so excited to share Nancy's lessons with you today, so let's dive right in. So great to have you with us today. How's your day going?
It's going pretty well. I'm back in Miami and we're having a bit of a windstorm. But other than that, I'm pretty safe and the day is off to a good start.
Amazing. Well, so excited to dig into your story. I guess to start, would love to maybe just hear a little bit about your background and eventually, what led you to start Briogeo. Where did you see the opportunity? Would love to get some perspective on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I have a pretty, untraditional background for a beauty founder because I didn't start my career in beauty. I am not a cosmetologist. I'm not a hairstylist. And so I actually started my career in finance straight out of undergrad. I went to the University of Virginia. And in 2007, I started a career in finance. And if you can recall back to 2007, it was a very tumultuous time for the finance industry. It was crazy. And, I was working in a really, really challenging job. It definitely wasn't my dream job, but I was just grateful to have a career because after the financial crisis, so many of my friends were getting laid off. And I was just grateful that I was still employed. But I knew that there was going to be something else that I was going to do with my career beyond finance. And unfortunately, in 2007, I lost my mom pretty suddenly. And it was the first time I had lost anyone close to me. And it was really the first time that I realized that life can be short and we really owe it to ourselves to do things that we're passionate about. And that's what really sort of triggered this soul searching journey for me to figure out what it was I was passionate about, because I was, at a point in my life where I was willing to kind of put it all on the line to pursue my passion. And when I was thinking about, what my passions were, I kept thinking back to the childhood memories that I had with my mom, who was a physician and a chemist. And growing up, we used to make so many of our beauty and personal care products at home. We would go to our local health food store and buy all sorts of oils and extracts and butters and transform them into these very simple and basic but functional beauty products. And I absolutely loved doing that. And ultimately, that is what became the inspiration for me thinking about how I could launch my own beauty brand rooted in clean, natural, high quality ingredients, but also really focused on creating formulas for all hair textures and types to really take a category like hair care that has historically been pretty segregated and try to create a brand and a product methodology that would actually unite people as opposed to separate them.
I love that. And I love the, the childhood inspiration, from your mom. So, I think for a lot of our listeners, they are in corporate, positions. I think thinking about taking that, leap into entrepreneurship. And I'd love to just go back to the moment in time when you made that decision. What did it take? Did you, do market research? Did you find your manufacturer? Did you already have an idea of what the brand would be? What was that kind of transition period between, a very different role in day-to-day life at Goldman and, leaving it all to kind of start this new identity as a founder?
Yeah, definitely. And I knew that if I was going to sort of leave this full-time career that I had been building for 7 years, and I was doing quite well at Goldman, to launch this beauty brand, I wanted to really be sort of certain that I was going into something that, you know, had a lot of, you know, potential and viability. And so I did do a lot of research. It's interesting. I don't know if founders, a lot of founders still put together like formal business plans, but that was really important for me, was to kind of like really make sure that I could articulate sort of my vision for the company and also sort of validate like the business viability by putting together, you know, like pro forma financial models to see if like the numbers actually made sense. And what I was doing at the time, because the beauty industry was just so different back then, like there wasn't this, you know, big sort of conglomerate of beauty founders and, you know, panels and conventions that you could go to and learn and tap into. It was like a little bit like the wild, wild west. Like there was no playbook. So I had to like literally write my own playbook. And at the time I was going to the New York Public Small Business Library because they had these databases where you could access these research reports. And at the time there were actual research groups that were putting out industry reports on the future of the clean personal care industry. And that's where I started reading about, who like the early players were, what the research analysts thought about the industry, that it wasn't just going to be a short-lived trend, but it was how the market was going to evolve. I was able to get data around comps to start like actually building sort of what that plan could be. And at the same time, I started doing a lot of work independently and then with an agency to help me sort of really develop the brand identity. So that was everything from, you know, what were our points of differentiation? So, you know, clean ingredients, natural, effective performance actives, a brand that celebrates all hair care, all hair textures and types, a brand that leverages sustainable packaging, building out those pillars, building out the mission, building out our visual identity. And so that really became just like this project that I was able to really sort of pour myself into as a way for me to, it was very therapeutic after losing my mom, being able to pour myself into a passion project. Yeah. But it was also a lot of work that I did up front to really feel confident, like, wow, if I'm gonna leave my career to pursue this, I really have a plan. And I validated sort of kind of what I needed to do in order to have a profitable business that could scale into the future.
And were there any, you know, as you thought about branding agencies and, you know, making these types of decisions, did you have anyone within the beauty industry that you leaned on, you know, just an advisor or someone you may have reached out to for guidance?
Yeah. And again, it's just, it's crazy because this was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago, and I had no connections to the beauty industry. Even the agency that, you know, did my first packaging iterations, they had never even worked on a beauty brand before. Their focus was on like food and beverage. And so it was literally just me leveraging my own intuition, my passion, my observations as a beauty consumer. And, you know, ultimately later, especially when we started partnering with retailers like Sephora, they were probably like my biggest, you know, mentor in helping me to really sort of scale my brand and identity and all of those things. But prior to that, I really didn't have anyone.
That's so fascinating. It's and also such a great lesson in terms of, you know, I think a lot of people have this belief that you have to come in as a startup founder and, you know, come from the industry itself. And you're such a great example of how, you know, you can overcome that stereotype. So I just love that angle from a founder story perspective. So I guess, you know, when you think about your career prior to launching Briogeo, what do you think were some of the most important skills that you took from you know, your years at Goldman or even prior work experiences that really translated into your work, you know, building the business?
Yeah, there were, you know, it's such a different business and industry, but there were definitely these, you know, skills that I developed. I mean, especially coming straight out of college, you really only have like book smarts. Like you haven't really sort of applied anything in the real, you know, world. Or if you did, it was always in safe spaces, like, you know, doing like a public speaking, like, you know, 3-minute pitch. It was always in these like sort of safe spaces, not like in the real world. And so I think for me, it was like being able to kind of take what I had learned in school and apply them in the real world helped me to develop these skills from, you know, being able to negotiate, being able to, you know, speak and present in high pressure environments. I think one of the things that I really learned too, and this is a feedback that I give to like a lot of younger people, because oftentimes a lot of, I think, younger people think that working quickly is a sign of success and validation, but it's really how do you work quick and efficiently, but also thoughtfully? And I feel like that's something that I really learned also, because I think it's true to kind of get ahead. You have to be efficient. You have to be quick. You have to be agile. But if you do those things in compromise of actually being thoughtful about the work that you're doing and strategic about the work that you're doing, it could actually be not so much a gift, but a bit of a curse in terms of how you produce things. So I think that blend of being agile, but very thoughtful and strategic about the work that I do is something that I developed there. You know, being able to work not just as a sole contributor, but being able to work with people internally and externally to make things happen. Like all of these skills that aren't necessarily unique to finance, but really can be sort of applied to so many different things. And ultimately, you know, having confidence in those things, I think, helps to create the confidence for being an entrepreneur, because at least you feel like you have some sort of foundation for being able to figure things out and do things the right way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that skill set is, you know, I think, applicable across so many asks of building a business. So I think super valuable. So, you know, in terms of the, you know, the positioning of Briogeo, I think clean beauty today, you know, you hear it all over, you know, and it's become such a, such a core part of, I think, what consumers, are looking for as they think about, product selection. For you, and, you know, particularly in the early days of building the business, how did you define this? And, you know, what did it mean from a product development perspective? Does it translate into sustainability, you know, transparency? What are the core tenets of what that means for Briogeo?
Yeah. So, you know, there's no sort of regulated term for what it means to be clean. And I would say actually in more recent years, retailers have actually played a pretty big role in helping to create definitions based upon their own sort of clean programs that they've developed within their retail sphere, whether it's, you know, clean plus planet positive at Sephora or conscious beauty at Ulta. You know, there are now sort of these frameworks, but, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago, when I was, you know, starting Briogeo, there really wasn't any sort of framework for it. And so I had to really sort of define what that meant for Briogeo. And when I was working with my chemist, it was really kind of thinking through, you know, what were the top most commonly used ingredients in hair care that have been linked to either health or environmental concerns. And those became sort of these six culprit ingredients that we kept out of all of our products. Because the truth is, especially when it comes to hair care, shampoos and conditioners, you know, you're not just applying them to your hair, but you're applying them to your scalp. If you're using them in the shower, they can get into your eyes, they can get into your mouth, they're all over your skin, they're going down the drain into the water system. So really sort of understanding that flow of all of the touch points of those ingredients, and then, you know, the impact that they could have to your health and the environment. And so the things that we sort of coined as our six free methodology were leaving out ingredients like silicones and sulfates, parabens, phthalates, synthetic dyes and DEA. These are ingredients that have been linked to endocrine disruption, hormonal imbalances, all sorts of things. And so our sort of method was like, when in doubt, sort of leave it out. And we also don't say that like all synthetics are bad, because they're not.
Right.
And not all natural ingredients are great for you either at certain levels. So there is flexibility within the term, but I do think we really sort of related it back to what we were doing with hair and being sort of mindful of those commonly used ingredients.
And did you feel like you had to compromise, you know, in terms of your, whether it's price point or, you know, the end product, or did you, because I feel like that's often what we hear is that, you know, to make things, whether it's more sustainable or more organic, there's a cost that needs to be kind of borne for that. So was that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, typically, you know, cleaner formulas will cost more money because a lot of the commoditized ingredients that you would use otherwise, they're a lot cheaper, and you have to kind of replace them with these cleaner or naturally derived alternatives. And so that can raise the cost. You know, same thing with elements of sustainable packaging, you know, post-consumer resins, there's so much high demand for it that it started to raise the cost of having a bottle that leverages post-consumer resin versus a virgin bottle. For sure, there are definitely cost considerations to, you know, creating more clean formulas and sustainable packaging.
And how did that ultimately, how did you kind of think about those decisions? Was it, you know, we will charge the customer a little bit more, or, you know, from a margin perspective, we'll make it up somewhere else?
I'm curious
about that.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I think being in premium beauty, you have a little bit more leverage from a price point standpoint. There's such a wide range. We noticed too that, you know, charging what we needed to charge to create healthy margins to support the broader business, we were still, you know, priced pretty competitively versus our peer set. But I know, you know, for example, within mass market, your ability to, you know, create a price within a certain range, it's just a lot tighter because of that sort of competitive price, narrow sort of set that exists on shelves. So I think by nature of, you know, being in the prestige category, we were able to create price points that were still competitive, but also sort of within norm for that category.
Right. Yeah. No, and I think your point around prestige is, you know, it's obviously you have a little bit more flexibility, which I think can, you know, make it a little easier in the long term as well.
Definitely.
So, yeah. So I guess in terms of how you think about innovation, so, you know, as you were building the business, obviously there's so many different kind of focuses as a CEO. And I think, you know, continuing to innovate, continuing to bring new products to market is such an essential part of building kind of a, you know, a really strong beauty brand. How did you think about that? Was it led by consumer insights? Was it, you know, based on product development? Curious, you know, what was your approach to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in the beginning, because there was just, you know, when I launched Briogeo 10 years ago, there was just so much white space within prestige hair. Like, we were sort of the first indie brand at Sephora within hair to launch right after Drybar. There were like six of us. For me, it was just really sort of seeing the opportunity set. Like, what were the products that, you know, I was either using or creating that didn't sort of exist in a clean format or didn't exist within prestige? And how could we make it better? How could we leverage, you know, more sort of interesting and effective ingredient complexes that just didn't exist? And so for me, actually, in the beginning, it wasn't so much relying on sort of consumer data per se, but it was more so really putting my own consumer hat on and being like, wow, there's so much missing from this category. Like, I wish I could shop this at Sephora, or I wish I could shop this type of product, but not have it be like petroleum based. Like, how can right. I create something clean? And so it was really kind of originally those two things. It was like, this formula is amazing, but these ingredients are not so great. So how do I create a clean version of that? Or this is just missing from, you know, a more sort of high quality, thoughtful ingredient perspective. And then as the years went on, I started to sort of just get inspiration from trying different cool things. Like I used to, and I still do, create my own sort of green smoothie concoctions by like researching different ingredients that were, you know, good for skin health or hair health or energy. And when I would research these ingredients, I would find that like, wow, like spinach and kale and matcha and apple, yeah. they actually have like hair health benefits too. And it was yeah. sort of linking some of what I was learning about food and nutrition back to hair care. And ultimately that's what inspired, you know, our superfoods collection, which ended up being, you know, when we launched it, one of the top selling shampoo and hair conditioners at Sephora ever, because it was such a unique sort of ingredient and approach to shampoo and conditioner that just hadn't existed in prestige in the past.
Wow. That's amazing. I love that. And I think also, you know, you were kind of helping through your innovation, setting a new standard, because, you know, as you rightly said, so much of this was so new to the industry itself. So that's even, you know, even more powerful, which is and so impressive. So, you know, you have gone on, you know, since launching the business in 2013 to win tons of awards for innovation, you know, Allure's Best of Beauty Award in prestige hair care. What are, you know, looking back and reflecting, it's, I think, now been a couple of years post post-exit, what do you attribute your commercial success to? Was it the brand? Was it, you know, your distribution strategy? Was it the team? Is there anything that really sticks out to you about, you know, what really led the company to break out in an industry that, you know, particularly in those days was so dominated by kind of the existing players?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a culmination of, you know, all of those different things. I think being able to partner with such a incredible and strategic retailer like Sephora from the beginning definitely was really sort of a platform for not only exposing Briogeo to so many new consumers, but like I mentioned before, having this really strategic partner to help me think through you know, the strategy for the brand and how we could really win and succeed together. And I think that coupled with really strong, consistent innovation and, you know, being able to really be ahead and at the forefront during sort of the shift of beauty marketing tactics, whether it was, you know, the rise of the beauty sampling box industry to the rise of the beauty YouTube influencer, and just being sort of on it at the pulse. I think the culmination of all of those things really helped to propel the brand forward.
Amazing. Amazing. So, you know, when you think about your leadership style and kind of, you know, you're obviously really young, at the point at which you started Briogeo, I think, was it age 29?
I actually think it was 28. Yeah.
I mean, that's just so incredible.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for you kind of building the business, developing a leadership style, is there anything that stood out in terms of the values or your approach to building that team, building that culture, and creating kind of that new identity really for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, hiring and building a team can be one of the most trickiest parts to scaling a business. And I think it's really important that when you're building a team, to not just hire for skill set, but to also, you know, hire for, you know, values as well, because ultimately that's really sort of, you know, what shapes a culture and what helps to just shape really good alignment on, you know, what's important to you as a founder, when scaling your business and company and being able to really sort of, you know, maintain that while inevitably evolving at the same time. And, you know, I always tell people too, you know, sometimes as an entrepreneur, things start to move quick and you just want to start filling seats and putting people in.
Yeah.
But really being very thoughtful about the structure and being very intentional about sort of what the scope of the role is, so that you have a really sort of clear understanding of like what it is you need and making sure that you're bringing in someone that understands those needs and that can really sort of drive their efforts towards creating success towards that. I will say in the beginning, it's really common to have more sort of generalists, but as you start, you know, to scale and expand, you definitely want to create more sort of centers of like focus within your team, because that's what's going to really allow you to maximize someone's, you know, skill set really productively. And so I think that that's one of, you know, the biggest things that I've learned is that when you start building out your team, it really, really is an evolution. And, you know, again, just making sure that you are really spending time with candidates to not just assess sort of their previous experiences and, you know, what they enjoy doing, but making sure that you really understand how you connect from a values perspective.
Yeah. And I think it's really also, it's really, I remember, you know, kind of starting my company as a founder, and it boils back, I think, to the core team that you first hire. I think that the values that are set kind of in the early days, it's just so important to ensure that those then, you know, are translated across the hiring process. So, you know, really couldn't agree more, you know, in terms of kind of how you thought about that. So, yeah, so, you know, I want to go back to a really interesting anecdote that you brought up earlier this year when you spoke at camp. We had asked just around, you know, M&A and your acquisition process. And I think, you know, your story really stood out amongst, you know, some of the others that we heard in terms of just kind of how it started. Would love for you to maybe just dive into that and kind of, you know, walk us through what that looked like.
Yeah, for sure. So for the first 6 years of Briogeo, I actually bootstrapped the company. And then in 2019, I brought on a private equity investor with VMG to really help support, not only with funding, but really helping me to professionalize the business, to build out a leadership team, and really get Briogeo to a place of being able to just run more efficiently. And like I said, you know, sort of from a place of just more professionalized operations to support the needs of the business. And it was interesting because as we started to build out leadership and we started to just be a lot more, you know, thoughtful about how we were investing in the future of the business, you know, Briogeo just continued to really rocket ship. And obviously, the pandemic was a scary time for a lot of businesses, but for Briogeo, it was actually such a powerful time because, you know, with salons being closed, a lot of people were figuring out how to do their hair routines on their own. And, you know, we had just great success throughout the pandemic. And we started getting, you know, some inbounds and interests from strategic acquirers, and we kind of held off and said, no, you know, now's not the right time. We just brought in an investor. There's, you know, so much to do and whatnot. But we continued to sort of get interest. And at one point I agreed with my investors, well, we should probably kind of bring a little bit more thoughtfulness to this and really sort of understand, you know, what the opportunity really is. Especially because there were multiple people sort of outreaching. And so we ended up hiring an investment bank to help us, you know, sort of navigate and really sort of understand what those opportunities were. And as I started to think through the future of Briogeo and sort of what those next big growth levers would be, because we had been in consumer retail for 10 years, And we had never really sort of had the resources or capability to expand into salon. I really thought, wow, you know, there is a world in which we could partner with a parent company to make that a reality, someone who has expertise within salon that can help us build that competency and really take Briogeo to the next level. And that was one of the things that I was really focused on when sort of thinking through the different opportunities. And ultimately, that's how I landed on the Wella company. They've been around for like 140 years. Wow. They have, yeah, it's really incredible. Their core focus is really on salon professional through hair and also through nail. And I just felt like they would be such a good partner that really sort of understood our business and that could help us take that next step towards growth.
Can you also maybe just walk us through, I remember you shared an anecdote of how you were flying to LA and you met someone in the lobby. Am I remembering this correctly?
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. I was in LA to do some management presentations. And, you know, there was just so much going on. It was like a really, really stressful time. And I was staying at a hotel in Santa Monica, and I was rushing to get my Uber to go to this presentation. And I was definitely pretty frazzled and pretty stressed walking through the lobby. And as I was walking through, I ended up making eye contact with Paula Abdul, the famous singer, talented human being. Yeah, and she was in the middle of talking to someone, and she locked eyes with me and told the person she was talking to hold on for a second, and came up to me and said, "You look like you're going somewhere really important." And I said, "I am." I said, "I'm in the process of, you know, navigating whether or not I'm going to sell my company, and I have this big presentation, and there's just so much going on, and I'm super stressed." And she says, "Well, if you have a moment, I would love to just pray for you, because I think you're going to do great, and let's just pray together." And she said this little prayer, and it was so beautiful and so magical. And I went on my merry way, but with this like total renewed sense of like energy and clarity and focus and confidence. And it was literally everything that I needed at that moment to kind of reshift my energy so that I could do, you know, a great job in this presentation. And we exchanged numbers before I left, and I text her, let her know that it was a great presentation thanks to her prayer. But yeah, it was a very, very special moment.
Yeah, I love that. It's just, you know, those moments in life, you know, that you can reflect back on.
Yes.
So now, you know, post acquisition, you know, you're an active investor across multiple startups. What are you excited about?
Yeah. So I think one of the things I'm really excited about, I mean, I think naturally because I'm in the beauty space, and when I started investing, so much of like the deal flow that I would see was focused on beauty. And I have a lot of incredible brand founders in beauty that I've supported, both from mentorship and investment. But over the past couple of years, I started to expand my network. And with that has come, you know, the opportunity to see flow outside of beauty also. And I think while there's still a lot of unknowns in the AI space, especially as it relates to regulatory and how it will impact our lives as just humans and personally, professionally, we're still at such the early stages. And I think that there's so much opportunity in that space. I mean, I even leverage, you know, AI pretty much in my daily life to help me do things that would take me a lot of time more effectively so that I can spend my headspace on things that, you know, really matter the most. And so I've made some investments in that space that I'm really excited about. And, you know, just starting to kind of learn outside of beauty through some of these investments and being able to talk to founders and learn about their ideas. And so that's been really, really exciting.
Yeah. And I guess also such a great way to learn, you know, about, you know, different industries and kind of expand I think some of your learnings, you know, from beauty into those industries and for those founders as well, which I'm sure they think is, you know, consider so valuable.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, the 2% is really focused on highlighting stories of people who are working to improve the stats around investing in diverse founders and just kind of making the playing field a little bit more equitable. I know that, you know, you are doing that in multiple different ways, but I'm curious, you know, what do you think it's going to take for us to get parity from this point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as you're aware, this past year, actually during Women's History Month, I launched a platform under nancytwine.com focused on building content and resources to help support female entrepreneurs throughout their journey. And it's something that I'm very, very passionate about. And it's something that I really also to encourage women who have created success as entrepreneurs to figure out in what unique way are you going to help pave the way for other women. And for me, it was the content idea. I'm actually launching a podcast in January called Maker's Mindset to create another forum.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I'm super excited about it. And for me, like, that's my thing. It's like being able to take my network and my experience to create this content to really help support other women. And I think that's a big part of the equation, because there are a lot of women who have really pushed through really tough circumstances to make it through the top. And the only way that we widen that pool and create easier, more successful outcomes for others is we've got to find, like, what is each of our unique ways in which we're going to help to lift up other women? Because as we start to gravitate towards that mindset, it really does become exponential. And that's how we really, really do become a force. So I think having that sort of commitment, thinking about it the same way that you would do, you know, philanthropy, what is your personal philanthropy towards supporting women? And I think that that's going to be how we do that and how we get there. And so I love, you know, obviously what you've done with your fund. And I think that, you know, again, it's just really sort of this collective and just bringing more people on board with that same mindset. And that's been your unique give back. It's helping women, you know, find capital that's going to be in a supportive sort of atmosphere to help them thrive and grow their businesses. And so that's really what I think it takes. I think it takes a collective commitment from us to continue paving the way and supporting in unique ways that we're all passionate about.
Yeah. And I would just add for you too, you know, role models, right? You need examples of success. And I think to change, particularly the investing industry, you know, they're not driven by anything more than, you know, financial returns.
Right.
So the more, you know, more role models we have of success, I think, the better. So thank you
totally.
For that.
And I'm actually glad you used that word. Yeah, no, thank you. You know, the role models piece, because I always say that seeing is believing. And when you see people who look like you doing the things that you want to do in your mind, it really sort of heightens your confidence and belief in what's possible. And I will say that there were many years where I was like just grinding away as an entrepreneur and I was heads down. I actually used to say like no to press and no to doing things like these, because I was like, I need to just be laser focused on my business. But then I realized, especially as I started to scale and come into a place of success, I'm like, no, I actually need to be out there more.
Yeah.
More people need to see what I'm doing and to see what's possible.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, we're now moving into our last set of questions. My favorite part, the lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions and just answer with whatever comes to mind first.
Okay.
So let's start with, what are the top, call it 2 to 3 products you can't live without?
Okay, so for hair, it's definitely Briogeo's Don't Despair Repair Deep Conditioning Mask, Holy Grail. It's our number one bestseller. I love a good mascara and I love Thrive Cosmetics volumizing mascara. It is so, so good. I also love Kosas's micro brow pencil. It is very, very good.
What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I mean, I guess like a lot of different things. I'm working on so many things with Briogeo. I have my passion projects. I have sort of like my wellness and fitness routine. It's what really gets me out of the bed in the morning is that like, wow, I have so much stuff to do. There's no other option.
What is your perfect day? How would you define a perfect day?
I think a perfect day, especially on the weekends for me, to be honest with you, is just not having too many plans or structure so that I can really sort of just relax and be in my thoughts and not feel like I have to like go, go, go. I can go for a workout. I can walk on the beach. I can go for a massage. I can have an impromptu sort of, you know, brunch with a friend. But I think not having too much structure on the weekends is a nice way to spend it.
To relax.
Yes.
Absolutely. Anything you want to plug or announce here?
Yeah. So again, one of the things that I'm so excited about and so passionate about is the growing incredible content that we have on nancytwine.com. These are articles that I helped to co-write that are really sort of nuggets from my entrepreneurial journey that I've turned into these learning lessons to help support other entrepreneurs. And I am so excited for the launch of Maker's Mindset podcast in January. And what I like to say is like, you know, I've been so fortunate to have created such an incredible network of women, people like you, and we would go to brunch and have these incredible conversations. And I'm like, wow, we shared so much. It would be so cool if other people could listen in on this. And that really is sort of the inspiration for Maker's Mindset.
I can't wait to listen into the first season. It launches in January?
In January, yes.
Fantastic. And where can our listeners find you online?
Yes. So listeners can find me on Instagram at Nancy Twine, also on LinkedIn, and my website, nancytwine.com. And again, stay tuned for Maker's Mindset, the podcast, and we'll be creating social channels on TikTok and Instagram for that as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for tuning in to the 2% for today's episode featuring Nancy Twine, founder of Briogeo. I hope you enjoyed learning about Nancy's journey as much as I did. See you next time.
Stay in touch with us on Instagram at Female Founders Fund and on Twitter at FCubeVC. And for those of you building the next billion-dollar businesses, we'd love to hear from you. Send all pitch decks to pitches@femalefoundersfund.com and we'll be in touch. And finally, if you're interested in working at one of our 45-plus female-founded startups, explore our job opportunities at jobs.femalefoundersfund.com. Make sure to subscribe to the 2% on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening. And stay tuned for our next episode with powerful women founding and funding the future. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us out too. Until next time, I'm Anu Dugal, and this has been the 2%.